Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Unauthorized Disclosure Podcast. I'm Kevin Gastola, and I'm joined by Rania Kalik. Hey, Rania.
Hey, Kevin.
And we're very pleased to be joined by Barry Eisler, who is the author of the recent novel, The Killer Collective. And he worked for 3 years in a covert position with the CIA's Directorate of Operations. And he's written several bestsellers, and we're very glad to have him on the show. Thanks, Barry.
Thank you, Kevin. Hello, Rania. Good to be here.
And so to start off, I'm not so sure that everyone who listens to our show is familiar with you. So I'd like to give you an opportunity to fill in some more of your background, talk a little bit about how you got into writing, and then we can dig into some of the setup for The Killer Collective.
I had a pretty conventional education, and I was patriotic in a fairly ordinary way in college and law school, and spent 3 years, as you noted, in the CIA. I wouldn't say that my worldview changed very much during the CIA. A lot of people who know my politics now ask things like, oh, did something happen? Did you participate in one assassination or coup too many and you realized it was all bad? It's nothing nearly as exotic as all that. Actually, what happened was about 12 years ago, I encountered what then was widely known as the blogosphere. And I would say that's probably what radicalized my politics by providing almost literally an answer or response to the establishment media of the day, which until then was where I was getting all my information. And not long before that, I started trying my hand at writing novels and got published. I write political thrillers, and so naturally those two interests of mine, changing political worldview and my interest in telling stories, combined such that most of my plots now are really courtesy direct from the U.S. government. I think if you're writing political thrillers, you want to have the highest stakes possible. And since America is capable of doing much more damage to itself than anyone else, certainly any non-state adversary is capable of doing to us, if you want to show those stakes, you can find them easily in today's headlines. So that's what I do.
And so go ahead and set up the Killer Collective. I understand, although I'm not familiar with every single novel in the whole line of novels that you've done for these
sure.
different characters, but you have John Rain, you've got Lydia Wright, and all of these, it's Livia, and all of these, all of these people are brought together in this novel.
Yeah, so this one has been compared in some reviews to a kind of Avengers Infinity Wars thing, where an Avengers Guardians of the Galaxy mashup, which is not a bad comparison. You swap out the superhero elements with spies, assassins, and political skullduggery. I have three series to date: my Natural Causes Assassin John Rain series, my Seattle Sex Crimes Detective Livia Lone series, and my Black Ops Soldier Ben Trevin series. And at some point, I started wondering what would happen if. That's where all these stories come from, ultimately, a what-if question. And here it was, what if Livia, who was trafficked to America from Thailand as a teenager and so traumatized that she sublimates not just by putting rapists in prison, but when she can, by putting them in the ground. What if she came across something that was so big that the people she was uncovering tried to have her killed? Like maybe, I don't know, a child pornography ring in, say, the Secret Service or something like that. And what if the people who wanted her killed wanted it done in a really low profile manner so that they would reach out to the premier natural causes assassin of the world? And that would be John Rain, who's living in Kamakura, Japan, and trying to retire. But Rain wouldn't take the hit because he won't kill women or children. What would Livia do then? She might reach out to this guy, Docs, a former Marine sniper from Rain's universe, who she ran into in the previous book. And I started thinking about all this. I was like, oh, this is really great. How would they all come together? And that's how the book was born. All these characters have quite different worldviews, priorities, pasts. All of them have a lot of trust issues. So putting them together under extreme pressure to see if they could form, well, if not a team, then at least a killer collective, was a lot of fun for me.
And what I think, not being terribly familiar with these characters before I opened the book, what I immediately appreciate and know from your work, and also having read the God's Eye View that you had put together, which was an Edward Snowden inspired one-off novel that you wrote. Having read that, I really appreciate what I'll call the realism that exists in your genre writing, which is that what I mean to say is you recognize that rather than just using conventions, you recognize that in Seattle, the police department has a consent decree, or you recognize that different parts of, and sometimes authors don't blend in those political realities when they're telling their stories.
Yeah, on this sort of thing, I would say, I wouldn't say there's a right or wrong answer. I mean, fiction can, there are all kinds of fiction, and ultimately it's what kind of fiction do you want to write and what do people like to read? But because I am so interested in the politics of our day, it's important to me to create realistic plots that reflect on things that are really going on in the world right now. And even to take it a step further by, for example, including in author notes at the end of each book, all my sources so that people can tell for themselves, okay, what parts of this novel were fiction and what parts were fact. So particularly for a novel like The God's Eye View, which centered on this government program called God's Eye, which is a program of warrantless bulk domestic surveillance. I didn't want people to come away from the book thinking, wow, Barry has a crazy imagination. It was a fun read, but I'm really glad we don't live in a world that has any of those programs or any of those technologies. I wanted everyone to know, hey, I didn't make up any of this stuff. On a couple programs, I speculated a little, mostly in the way of reading between the lines, but here are the actual technologies that I'm depicting. Here are the actual programs. This stuff is all real. So hopefully, it's always an interesting question about how many eyes you can open or minds you can change. I know it's possible, but the ratio is probably really bad. But still, my hope is that people will finish the book, read the author notes, and maybe look at the world a little differently than they did at the outset.
You wrote this already having sets of characters and deciding that you wanted to blend them. But when you're coming up with your ideas for novels, it seems like you're someone who relies heavily on what is going on in news headlines to help maybe find the grist for your narratives. And maybe more so than just other people who might draw from like their influences and the sort of kind of books they like to read before they got into writing.
Right. Yeah, it's because every day I spend a ton of time reading reading good news sites like Shadowproof, for example. I mean, it's not that I have no exposure to the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, but I find what's available in establishment media is fairly predictable in terms of its worldview. So I read really widely about developments in the country and the world, and frequently I'll come across something that intrigues me and that can become the basis for a story. One example would be this is a long time ago, really at the dawn of the of the war, the so-called war on terror. I read about it was an assassination, which we like to euphemistically call targeted killings. It was an assassination in Yemen. A Hellfire missile fired from a drone blew up a Jeep, and there was an American citizen in that Jeep. And not only was there no outcry at the time in America, I think this was it was maybe late 2001, so not long after 9/11. Not only was there no outcry, actually the CIA had clearly leaked the information about what had happened. It was as though the CIA was taking a bow for killing an American citizen without any recognizable form of due process. And I thought that without even taking a position on the legality or the morality or even the efficacy of that sort of government behavior, it just intrigued me to think that, okay, we're in a different world now, where nobody cares about due process or law, that sort of thing. It's all about how many people are you killing. And then that notion of the government having a list of undesirables who it was going to extrajudicially kill, who it was going to assassinate, that became the basis of my third book, Winner Take All. And what's funny, especially in retrospect, is I get a lot of weird things right, things that are proven to be right in retrospect. So, for example, in that third book, which I wrote in, I think it was published in 2004, I was writing it in 2003. One of my characters is explaining that there's a list of terrorists and terrorist financiers who the U.S. government is assassinating. But my character says, but nobody would be so crass as to call it a kill list. We call it the International Terrorist Threat Matrix or something like that. And then years later, the New York Times reported in that article on Terror Tuesdays and John Brennan and Obama that there is a list, but it's called the Disposition Matrix. So I was right about it being called a matrix. And it's funny, if you just think of like what's the stupidest, blandest sounding euphemism you can come up with for what is otherwise a really comprehensive, far-reaching and scary government program, you can probably guess something that'll be fairly close to reality. Anyway, that's where my ideas come from. I read about things that are new, interesting, and disturbing, typically coming from the U.S. government, and those become the basis for my plots.
Well, speaking of the U.S. government, it seems like a lot of times the media in the U.S. doesn't sound that different from right. what the U.S. government is saying. Yes. And so I'm wondering, in your experience, what is your take on the way the media covers foreign policy? Also, do you incorporate the sort of media stenography of government speak into your writing process?
Oh God, how do I do this without talking for the rest of the day? Those are such interesting questions to me. Okay, so the first one about how the media covers foreign policy. Actually, a premier example was what you tweeted from, I don't know, I think it was 2 or 3 days ago. Tulsi Gabbard was on that. I only see clips
Morning
of
Joe.
Shows. I never.
Morning
yeah, thank
Joe.
You, Morning Joe. Thank you, Joe Scarborough. I don't watch these shows except in clips. And the reason I watch them isn't to be informed about whatever is supposed to be the underlying substance, but more because of what you learn about groupthink and doublethink in the establishment media. And that clip with Tulsi Gabbard was such an interesting and telling example. First, the way – I mean, there are so many elements of it, as you pointed out. The fact that – I don't remember the name of the woman who was asking – Tulsi Gabbard about like, but what do you say to those American soldiers who are in Syria fighting Assad? And Tulsi Gabbard had to say they're actually not fighting Assad. That's not their mission. Their mission is to fight ISIS. I mean, it was just
Casey Hunt,
Thank you. I don't mean to, I'm not trying to put anyone down like Joe or Casey. Again, like I'm not particularly familiar with the shows. I only see clips on the when they're distributed on the internet. I don't actually tune in. And then they were making these faces, Casey Hunt in particular, like what? Like, well, don't you think Assad is an enemy? And she was so you know what was interesting? She was making a Tucker Carlson face. It was that like really scrunchy, like what? I mean, I'm not putting anyone down. I don't know what my face looks like when I'm really concentrating. It probably doesn't look like what I think, but it was just.
No, but I know what you're saying. It was like a face of like, oh my God, I've never heard anybody say this before, which is like, really?
Yes, thank you. Exactly. Like this doesn't compute. You're not using a framework that doesn't fit in my brain. I'm not trying to put anyone's IQ, like Casey Hunt might have a phenomenal IQ. I have no idea. But the way her brain has been shaped and inculcated by too long exposure to official US discourse and her stenography is such that if you try to introduce any sort of a fresh perspective, like how about if we talk about US interests without using labels like enemy and adversary? Let's just try. I mean, I'm not saying you can't, like, just set those toys down for a minute. You can keep them right in front of you so you can pick them up at a moment's notice. But let's set those toys, that terminology down for a moment and talk about this topic in a different, using a different framework, the framework of U.S. interests, which is what Tulsi Gabbard was doing. She wasn't taking the bait of saying like, yes, you know, Assad is an enemy. And then everyone goes like, oh, he's an enemy. I mean, I keep coming back to 1984. That book should be read and reread. It's unbelievable how much insight. The 2 Minutes Hate, Emmanuel Goldstein, it's all in there. And you could duck speak. You can see it again and again in the establishment media. So in terms of stenography, really, how does it doesn't matter who's occupying the White House at any given time, but how does the U.S. government want America to look at certain figures as enemies or at least as adversaries? These are simple or as bad guys. How often do you hear that term in media? I mean, it's a child's term, and yet it's constantly used in official media. So this is one way I would say that that the establishment media works. And actually, there's a lot of attention is paid to this notion that there's this existential battle between the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. And I'm not saying that the Democrats and the Republicans don't squabble over this and that, but their areas of overlap are much more significant. What's most significant, like I think if you really want to understand U.S. politics, it's better to set – first of all, Democratic Republican is a very poor guide because what I like to call the Democratic and Republican wings of the party cooperate on much more than they disagree about. I'm not saying there's not a dime's worth of difference, because that's the other simplistic reaction, the sort of duck speak reaction. People are like, are you saying there's not I'm not saying that. There are some important differences, obviously. What I'm saying is that the areas of overlap, for example, on war spending, on military spending and war spending, on the notion that America is a force for good in the world and that we can create good in the world by using our military, by using force, the notion of American exceptionalism. These things are baked into our psyches in the kind of schooling we get. Noam Chomsky has written a lot about this. And those are the things that if we want to change, if we want to do better, we have to become aware of that sort of hidden programming and stop focusing so much on the obvious stuff like Nancy Pelosi clapped in a kind of funny way at the State of the Union. And that shows that, wow, she really stuck it to the president. I mean, like, I just don't care about stuff like that. It's mean. Silly. Yeah. So anyway, so that's one way that the media operates, this kind of stenography, or what I heard journalist Bart Gellman once referred to, and I've used this term in my novels ever since, information laundering. And by that, what I take that to mean is just like money laundering, like you acquired the money in some sort of illegal or illicit way, and you can't just spend it in the overt economy now without the illicit nature of the money being discovered. So you have to clean it. You have to put it through some sort of channel so that the money then seems to be legitimate and now you can spend it. And the premier instance of information laundering, which I used, I might have used it in God's Eye View. I might also have used it in my book Inside Out, but it's omnipresent, so it's always fun to use. It's this: in the run-up to the 2003 American war in Iraq, Dick Cheney himself or some of his people leaked to the New York Times the notion that Saddam Hussein was acquiring dual-use aluminum tubes that he was using in his weapons of mass destruction, his nuclear program. So that information was leaked to the New York Times directly from Cheney's office. And then the New York Times wrote the article up, and there was a lot of fear and consternation. Oh my God, Saddam Hussein, weapons of mass destruction. Now, it's true that in the article is qualified. It always says, officials say. But readers don't really notice that. I mean, it's appearing in the New York Times that it seems quite legitimate and trustworthy because of that. Nobody pauses to say, well, who are these anonymous officials? What's their actual agenda? Most people just don't pause to ask those questions. Anyway, so this is information laundering. It's a Dick Cheney office. It's a government press release that's released to the New York Times, which then types it up as a form of stenography. And then to complete the loop, Dick Cheney himself goes on the Sunday morning talk shows. And in service of his argument that Saddam Hussein is trying to acquire weapons of mass destruction, he cites the New York Times article, and the loop is complete. And at that point, the information has been completely laundered. Really, what we had here is just a press release. Dick Cheney said Saddam Hussein is trying to acquire weapons of mass destruction. But if he stood up himself and said that, the public would know that to discount it, just like if a salesman is trying to sell you a suit and you know the salesman's on commission and he says you look great in that suit, you'll be like, well, maybe, but I know he's on commission, so I should evaluate the information accordingly at some sort of discount. The public would do that if Dick Cheney himself just made a claim. But if he launders it through the New York Times and then cites the New York Times article as evidence of the claim, the public swallows it whole. So that's another function of the establishment media. What I love that term, information laundering. And
that's really good. I hadn't heard that before. That's like brilliant.
Steal it, use it. It's genius. It really works so perfectly. So you had it, and there was a second part to your question, which I don't remember now because I got so interested.
I think you answered whatever I asked pretty thoroughly. Okay. What you were saying fascinated me so much, I kind of forgot what my question was. But nice. I will add this. I mean, I'd love to know your thoughts on just like the way now, just both, again, the U.S. government and the media who they launder information through. It's like you said something about this on Twitter about how everything now is seen through the prism of Putin. Like he's the ultimate puppet master. It's like that everything. So talk a little bit about that.
Oh my God. There's so much to say about that. Okay. So the first thing I think is this. One of the things I feel like I've gotten better at as I've gotten older and more experienced in the world is to not get too distracted by the specific facts in front of me, but to try to analyze those facts through a framework of pattern recognition. How does what seems new and that's in front of me right now, how does this fit any sort of pattern that has existed more widely and for a longer time? And so the primary way I look at the hysteria, and I do think it's mostly hysteria. It's not to say that there's no kernel of truth in any of it. And it's not to say that none of it is going to be proven to be true, but still, I do think that a lot of the coverage we've seen of Russia, Putin, and the possibility of collusion has been hysterical in its tone. So I asked myself, have there been other hysterias in, for example, U.S. history? Have there ever been witch hunts, literal witch hunts, communist witch hunts in the 50s? Did we ever, for example, get so hysterical about the idea of fifth columnists of different ethnicities, specifically, say, Japanese people, that we actually rounded them up and put them in prison camps with absolutely no due process? Did we ever do anything like that? And did it seem at the time to all make sense? It was perfectly logical. And yet in retrospect, we realize what a grotesque injustice and what a shameful episode it was. So I try to look at what's happening now through that sort of lens of other things that have already happened and that seem like it. And that's how I look at Russia. I mean, if anyone who's watched Rachel Maddow on Russia, she's really devolved into like a parody of Glenn Beck at his worst with the blackboard. It's amazing to me that clip from a week or so ago where, back to information laundering or stenography, she was just repeating completely uncritically, even amplifying the not CIA, the organization that's above that, the DNI, the National Intelligence Directorate. She was repeating their claims that Russia could hack the power grid in various American cities. And she was like, what would you do? You're in the middle of a polar vortex. It's 40 degrees below zero. What would you do? It was just crazy. There was no journalism at all. There was no analysis. There was no caution about, well, there was no perspective about, look, is government fear mongering a thing? Do governments like populations to be in a state of fear where people can't access their cognition and are more easily manipulated?
She was putting her audience in the state of fear. I mean,
yes, exactly.
And she never actually, after it all happened in Russia, and she might have mentioned the Chinese, I don't remember, but after nobody from outside of America shut off the power grid, she hasn't gone back and said, oh, by the way, like, my bad.
Yeah, exactly. Which I could respect because we all have bad moments, all of us, and all you can really do. I mean, I have an entire page on my website called Mistakes. I mean, I do a really careful vetting process of every novel I write, including research and consultation with experts, and I show the manuscripts to experts, and then there's the whole editorial and copy editing, proofreading. But inevitably, something sneaks through, and some reader will point it out, and when that happens, I call it out on my mistakes page because nobody's perfect. And all you can really do to deserve your reader's trust is, when you make a mistake, call it out, reflect on it, try to come to grips with what went wrong so that you can cost effectively do better next time. I mean, there's no shame in that. In fact, I think we can take a lot of pride in that. And yet. So when I see clips like that, I feel like, yeah, this is definitely a kind of modern hysteria, and historians will look back and they'll analyze it as a hysteria, but we can't recognize it now. By the way, that's part of the pattern. I'm like, find me a historical hysteria, a moral panic, where the people who were caught up in it recognized it at the time as a moral panic or hysteria. They can't, of course. That's practically the essence of the moral panic, is that you can't recognize it when you're caught up in it as what it is. So anyway, that said, I also want to add that there are some journalists who I hugely respect, specifically Marcy Wheeler and Barrett Brown. And they both think that there's a lot to this collusion angle. Jim Risen also seems to think it. I have a lot of respect for him as well. And so even though I'm primarily analyzing the Russia thing through this pattern, I want to say in fairness that there are some journalists who I think are terrific, really smart, insightful, level-headed people, and they disagree with me on this. So maybe I'm wrong. And if I am, I'll put it on my mistakes page happily. But I think the Trump ascension has been shocking to the psyche of large segments of America. It was to mine. I wasn't expecting it at all. And this is just my take on human nature, that in the face of some shocking event, an event that violates the laws of reality as we previously understood them, it's natural for humans to reach for an external explanation. I think this is just intrinsic to human nature. So if we lived in a more primitive time and something that violated the laws of reality as we understand them happened, we would explain it by reference to witchcraft or sorcery or astrology or something like that. But because we're modern and sophisticated, we don't believe in those things, but we do believe in Putin. But it's the same psychology. That's my take. What I try to do, with really not very much success, which is itself kind of interesting, is mostly I'm just trying to have a remedial conversation with people online. Like, I'm not trying to get people to change their conclusions. So if you really believe that Putin is a government mastermind, and like everything Trump does, for example, is because he's a Putin asset and there's a P tape and Putin controls Trump's every move, I'm not trying to get you to not believe that anymore. What I am trying to do is to get you to set it down for just a minute. So what I'll say to people is, look, logically, it's possible that Trump is a Putin asset and that everything Trump does is explainable because of that. But let's see if we can just use our imaginations for a moment and think, are there any other explanations for Trump's behavior besides that one? I'm not saying that one is wrong. Just as an imaginative exercise, can we come up with any other explanations for why Trump is doing what he's doing? And it's interesting to me, like, I think that's a really important exercise for humans to do. And Rhonda, actually, I think of it with regard to you, because you get hit with this, it's just like, it's, to paraphrase Oscar Wilde, it's worse than libelous, it's stupid. This notion that you're some kind of Assad apologist or something like that, it makes me crazy, and I try to
that is where I get my orders. Every day I wake up and I'm like, what does the leader of Syria want me to do and say on Saturday?
And it's so interesting in a lot of ways, like, even in addition to the fact that as an explanation for your journalistic behavior, it's a silly explanation, like a moment's thought and you realize it's probably not that. But even beyond that, I try to do this, like, the most remedial thing I can do with people is I say, you know what? Logically, that's possible. It doesn't violate the laws of physics as I understand them. Like you're not claiming that Rania flew to the moon and back, which I would say, come on, that's impossible. Yes. Well, that journalist is, you know, taking her orders or his orders from some foreign leader who we all know has to be an enemy or an adversary, because otherwise we understand the world if we don't put people like labels like bad guys on people. Okay, logically that's possible. But then I just ask people, it's almost like I come from a judo background. It's like judo or aikido. Like, I'm not trying to fight you. I'm trying to like align my energy with yours by not exactly agreeing with you, but by acknowledging you may be onto something here. But can you think of any other reason that and I'll even hint, I'll be like, is it possible that, I don't know, just thinking out loud here, like the journalist has seen disastrous U.S. war after disastrous U.S. war, and every one of them has been justified in the name of humanitarianism. You don't have to go back that far in history, but Iraq and Libya, and think of the poor Yazidis on the mountainside, and Gaddafi is trying to, because we're going to bomb Libya and we're going to help Libya and it's all going to turn out well. Is it possible that a journalist has seen that pattern again and again and again, and is now understanding calls for war in America, an American war in Syria, by reference to that pattern, and so is just a little bit skeptical about A, whether the war is really is motivated by humanitarian tensions, and B, whether it really will have the positive outcome even for its intended, its ostensible recipients, as you say. I'm just asking, is it possible? And it's amazing to me how resistant people are to doing for me what I've already done for them. Is I've said, like, yes, it's possible. I'm not saying it's impossible that Trump gets his orders from Putin. Is it also possible that blah, blah, blah? And people, they won't do it. They won't let go of their primary framework, no matter how tenuous it is, just as a matter of like logic and likelihood. And I find that it's disheartening, but it's also really interesting. Can I tell you one more recent instance of this that really interests
me? Of course. Okay, go
just
for it.
Because it just happened to me yesterday on Facebook. So I tried to get people to talk about socialism without using the word socialism and without using the word capitalism. And I said, let's just try this. I literally said, as a personal plea, will you indulge me? Could we just try this as an experiment? I'm curious. Let's talk about socialism without using the word socialism and capitalism. Let's talk about it instead using the following framework. Let's consider that in America, the government, using taxpayer money raised from taxpayers, publicly creates roads and schools and a post office, police departments, fire departments, emergency services, and a military. And these are all things that the government creates using taxpayer monies that are more or less available to all as public goods. And we don't consider those things to be bad. I mean, we don't consider them to be socialism, but I'm trying to do the experiment without using the bad words that we've all been Emmanuel Goldsteined about, and that have become not aids to thought, but rather hindrances. And those things are not considered bad. Can we talk about why those things aren't bad, but government, taxpayer-funded, government-provided education, college education, as opposed to just K through 12, would be bad? And why it's okay for the government to provide health care to soldiers and veterans, and that's okay, but it would be bad if the government provided health care more widely. Can we talk about it that way? And I said, oh, and one other thing, please, no Venezuela. We can't talk about that unless you also want to talk about Denmark, Finland, and Sweden. Then no shouting Venezuela as the answer to whatever it is you think we're talking about. Let's just talk about it in this framework. And people, they can't do it. It's just amazing to me. One guy, he just did it. He's like, Venezuela, Venezuela. And I said, come on, Venezuela. And he said, you're not going to get – he literally said, Barry, you're not going to get to stop talking about Venezuela because it's – you know, I know why you want to. He said this because you're a socialist. And I said, so it's interesting to me. I'm actually – I don't consider myself to be a socialist. But and all I'm trying to do is to get you to set down this toy for just a minute. I'm not trying to take it away from you. It's right there in front of you if you feel you need to pick it up again. But I'm just trying to get to see if we can talk about this topic in a slightly different way. And – humans seem to find the possibility of a different framework so threatening sometimes that they won't let go of the one they're attached to. I think that happens when we get really emotionally attached to certain outcomes. We start building our defenses really far out. Even if we're attached to a crazy framework like Rania Kallag is an Assad apologist, or such and such is, like Greenwald gets this all the time. Where do you get your rubles, comrade? I'm like, oh my God.
Wow, that was pretty good. That was pretty good.
Thank you for that. Well, you know, I do narrate my own book. And it's just, it's worse than offensive. It's pathetically stupid. Like, have some dignity. Say something that's not just a cliche and stupid. But it's comforting to people, and if it's comforting, they want to engage in it. So that's my overall take on the Trump-Russia thing. There does seem to be a certain amount of smoke regarding possible collusion. At least several journalists who I really respect think there is a lot to it. But overall, I think it's even in spite of the fact that people like Marcy and Jim and Barrett, if they were on the show, they would probably be disagreeing with me. And I appreciate that and I respect it. Nonetheless, I would say despite that, I don't see how anyone could reasonably claim that what we're experiencing in American political discourse right now, specifically regarding Putin, the mastermind, the all-powerful and omniscient, is a hysteria. It's a modern
hysteria.
It's a mania. And it's a terrible thing because it's primarily because, well, it's an inaccurate way of understanding reality. And anytime you're applying an inaccurate framework or prism for understanding reality, well, like if you had a distorted prism as you tried to move through the world, you would bump into things and get hurt, and that's bad. But specifically with regard to a nuclear armed power, it's extraordinarily dangerous to have an inaccurate framework for trying to manage a relationship, and yet we do.
You know, I guess I have a little bit more sympathy towards people who maybe really are like convinced, like they really are, like their minds have been hijacked, right? Like by the body snatchers. And they're just like really convinced. But then there's this like layer of people who are just completely opportunistically pushing this.
Yes.
And that's what really makes me angry, because of what you say, it's just so dangerous. And also, you know, it's gotten to a point where now it's being used to silence people who are just saying things you don't like. Like Tulsi Gabbard says something about, you know, we need to end the wars.
Yes.
And then you have this media apparatus, this group of like grifters really start saying that she's backed by Russia, which is just like so insane and just out of thin air.
And said, I shouldn't laugh because it's like, this is really
horrible. It's funny. You have to. You have to.
I know.
Laugh
exactly. Like, it's so mad. Yeah, you're right. Sometimes I try, I ask a question of whether I'm like, is this cynical or clinical? And sometimes it's hard to tell.
Yeah.
A lot of it definitely is clinical. People honestly believe it. And I'm sympathetic to that because, look, I'm sure we all have mistaken notions that infect the way we relate to the world. And that's unfortunate. We should try to correct those as best we can. But yeah, to actually deliberately, knowingly, cynically make money off this shit that's so caustic and so personally caustic, because it's so much of it is really defamatory. But then also you're playing with nuclear fire. That's just another level of abhorrent. So it's you know, that tweet specifically that you're referring to, the one that I tweeted, was, I said, it's interesting, like this framework of, is it good for Putin or bad for Putin, has become the only framework that we can use to evaluate our own foreign policy decisions. Think of how crazy that is. I mean, like at the margins, you could say, I think it's good for Putin that we haven't nuked Moscow today, right? I mean, it's true. I think that's good. I don't think he would like it if we nuked Moscow. Did Putin cause that? Do we say like, well, then shit, we should nuke Moscow because Putin wouldn't like it, or we shouldn't hold back from nuking Moscow because it would be bad for Putin if we did? Like, that's just completely, it's almost a level of mental illness to think that way. And yet so much of the country is caught up in it. And as you said, it's now being fed by cynics and charlatans, which is another thing about human nature. Whenever a framework takes place, like this is something I've observed about marketing and politics, the hard part is establishing the framework, getting from zero to get people to establish a framework and then to see reality through that framework. But once you've established the framework, what happens in the human brain is all sorts of cognitive biases come in, such that we screen out information that would tend to undercut the framework, and we vacuum in information that seems to bolster it. And so charlatans, whether it's in religion or politics or anywhere else, when they recognize that a framework has taken root, they'll cynically exploit it to make money. And that's what I see right now. Like, I don't know what happened to Rachel Maddow. She might actually believe all this stuff, which is to me a slightly more charitable explanation for her behavior. On the other hand, I think she makes something like $5 million a year. I'm not trying to put her down for this. If somebody waved $5 million a year under my nose, it would have an effect. I hope it wouldn't have the kind of pernicious effect I think it's had with her. But when your ratings have gone through the roof in a way that's correlated with Russia scaremongering, it's probably going to, that sort of system of incentives is going to infect the things you really believe, because it's so good for your bottom line. And that to me is probably what's happened to Rachel, who used to do good journalism, I think.
So it strikes me, before we wrap, it strikes me we're really talking about a consensus here and how it's enforced. And the example that we've used of Tulsi Gabbard is of somebody who goes on and they're in this environment. And because they don't conform to that consensus, it's almost impossible to have any conversation with the people who are present because they don't want to. They want to stay on this script that they have. They don't want to go in another direction.
Right.
I want to
almost that they can't. Yeah. It's not just that they don't want to. I mean, I think almost literally, they cognitively can't.
There's that. Or
watching Casey Hunt, I think she was really. I think she was actually struggling to process what Tulsi Gabbard was saying. It wasn't like conscious resistance. Her brain just wasn't able to process it. I mean, this is a small difference, but it just interests me. Is that sometimes it's won't, but other times I think it's can't because of all.
You know, she also like looked angry. I mean, it was like this look of like you're saying like I cannot compute, but it was also this look of like anger and outrage. Like, how dare somebody say this out loud on
right?
But then you have
then
you have Willie Geist, who's like, there are people out there who will watch this and they will think. And when you say it like that, what it is it's showing your awareness that in the circles in which you move, you won't be able to defend your actions on set here if you don't act adversarial, if you aren't hostile towards Tulsi Gabbard. So you're trying to save your own reputation so that you aren't too amicable with the guests that you have on air. Because
that's a really good point.
Because
you're right.
Because socially, you won't be accepted if you treat Tulsi Gabbard with any sort of what I would consider would be just be a general politeness when you have a guest on your show. You know, like if I have somebody on Unauthorized Disclosure, if we do, we're not just going to constantly make them feel uncomfortable for giving us their time because they agreed to come on our show. So anyways, I'd like to ask you a creative question before we wrap, which is how this affects what you might be trying to do with your novels because this framework has come back into play. I mean, you might have thought as a writer that you had left this because the Cold War was over and you didn't have to retread all this ground. And to me, it seems like you might look back to the 80s, you might look back to the early 90s, you might look back to even the 70s, late 60s and say, what can I do that's even fresh with this? Because we've already retread this ground and it doesn't seem like we can get any clearer understanding of the world by bringing out those tropes again.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. You know, when the Cold War, well, when it was believed that the Cold War had ended before we found a way to gin up this new one, there was a fair amount of talk in thriller writing circles about whether, you know, is the thriller dead? Which even at the time I thought, what? I mean, why would that be? Like one kind of thriller, you won't be able to, you'll only be able to write as a historical thriller now, I guess, since the Cold War is over, the Berlin Wall has fallen. But it seems sort of silly. Even at the time, it seemed silly to me to suggest that because you couldn't write a contemporary Cold War thriller anymore, that there would be no more thrillers to write. I would say this. Governments, well, I.F. Stone said all governments lie, right? And as a corollary to that, I would broaden out and say all governments do bad things. And the more powerful and secretive government becomes, see if you can guess the one I'm thinking of, the more bad things it will be capable of. And because to me it's axiomatic, it's an axiom of human nature that the powerful will prey ruthlessly on the powerless, absent transparency and accountability. I'm certain, we don't even need to read it in the newspapers, although we can, in media, the government is doing a lot of really bad stuff. And if you write political thrillers, you'll have an unending source of new material to work with. The sources will, the subject matter will be different. If you'd asked me 10 years ago, Barry, do you think you'll be able to write a contemporary Cold War thriller again? I would have said, no, the Cold War is done. It would have to be a historical, or you have to write some other kind of thriller. So now I would have been wrong about that. Now, if you want to, you can write a contemporary Cold War thriller. And in fact, there are some elements subtle because it wasn't really the point of the book. But in my latest, The Killer Collective, Rain is just ruminating at one point. Rain is my natural causes specialist. And he's ruminating about whether some people might ask him to kill a high-profile target, and he's not going to do it for a variety of reasons. But he thinks it's sort of tempting, he says, because it would be so easy to do it and to blame it on the Russians. And that was just my nod to the omnipresence of the Putin does everything, he's the puppet master framework, so that you can do anything in the world and misdirect people into thinking it was Putin. Anyway, so that's, I guess, the way contemporary events affect the kind of plots I write, is I'll just leave it up to the government to do whatever bad things it's going to do. And then what always interests me most, whether it's politics or fiction or just life generally, it's human nature. It's what we can learn about human nature from experiences, from just what's happening either to those individuals or what's happening in the world. Those things interest me enormously. And so what's happening now with regard to like depositioning politicians or journalists you disagree with, you don't engage the argument, you try to undercut them somehow personally by suggesting their tools of Putin or Assad or whatever. Like, that sort of thing is really interesting to me on a human nature level. And so I will try to bring those sorts of things out in my fiction in the guise of, you know, lots of action and romance and exotic settings and realistic spycraft and the other things that on the surface hopefully make my books fun to read. To compare it, the process to making food, I would say I try to write, they're stories, they're entertainments, as Graham Greene called his novels, and they have to succeed as entertainment, and I hope they do. If they were food, I would be very concerned that they taste good, but also I always want to make sure they have nutrition in them so that people are not just pleased by the taste, but also nourished.
All right, well, Barry, we want to thank you for coming on the show. Again, for people who are listening, it's called The Killer Collective. And it's just out. You can find it, I imagine, in any store that sells books. I know you could also buy it off Amazon.com or any other mass marketing sites that sell books. So thank you, Barry. We really appreciate you giving us your time.
Oh, Kevin and Rania, it was such a pleasure. Thank you. And Rania, it was really it was just great to meet you in person after following all your great work online. So,
well, thank you for saying that, and then feeling is mutual, and thank you for all the wonderful work you've done, and thank you so much for coming on the show. Hopefully we can have you back on at some point in the future.
I would completely enjoy that. Thanks again, guys.
Thank you to all of our patrons for making this show possible. We have about 207 of you, and we're very grateful to have your monthly support. To those of you who are regular listeners, or to anyone who stumbled upon this interview with Barry Eisler, let me take a moment to encourage you to become a patron of the Unauthorized Disclosure podcast. All you have to do is go to patreon.com/unauthorizeddisclosure, patreon.com/unauthorizeddisclosure. I'm Kevin Gastola, and I co-host this podcast with Rania Kalik. We're both journalists, and we believe that we should use our show to feature guests who are rarely given platforms on talk radio or news networks, to have them offer perspectives that are rarely heard on the establishment news media programs, or especially in this climate. As we talked about in this show, we got into the issues around blaming or ascribing everything that is wrong to Vladimir Putin or Russia. That's something that we address on this show on a regular basis because it stamps out dissent. It targets people who are offering alternative viewpoints about how U.S. foreign policy should be carried out. We spend every episode really focusing on many of the lies and distortions that were prevalent in past weeks. Typically, we rant about rather enraging topics, but we're never afraid to have fun or to share a laugh now and then when it's appropriate, or sometimes it's inappropriate, but we try to have a blend of seriousness as well as casual humor every so often. I think that if you go back to our archive, where we do about 40 episodes every season, you'll find that a lot of our shows have a sense ability to them that is both engaging and entertaining. So please, if you like what you heard this week, I encourage you to become a patron. go to patreon.com/unauthorizeddisclosure. And thank you again to everyone who supports our show.